The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week...
Actually, when we were about to start the Horrors tour, Alejandro's synth broke, eventually like located somewhere in North Acton that was an expert in repairing analogue synths, and we got it back on the day of the Roundhouse.
Wow.
Once that happened, we bought a second one because we realised how important it was. We literally wouldn't be able to play a gig.
Toy Talk to us about vintage synthesizers, the perils of hype, and why bands don't make enough records these days. And there's new tracks coming out from Django Django, VCMG, and Fucked Up. All that in this week's Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, and thanks for having us in your ears this week. Please welcome our star guest, Jude Rogers.
Hello.
Michael Han.
Hello, Alexis.
Hello, hello. How are you two doing? What have you been up to, Jude?
What have I been up to? I've been preparing to an interview, which I'm doing tomorrow, for another publication, with Henry Rollins.
Right.
He's Mr. Humour, isn't he?
Pretty funny guy.
I've had very mixed reports on what he's like in interview situations, so I quite like that, going into that. So okay. Yeah.
Are you a Henry Rollins fan? Are you a Black Flag fan? Are you a Rollins
Not
band
particularly.
Fan?
I think he's an interesting character. I don't know a great deal about his music. This is why I've been swatting up. I'm asking him lessons he has learned in his life. Mm. Thank you, Michael.
No more passing notes. the thing is not allowed. It's cheating. Yes, I expect he is an intriguing character.
Yeah, we listened to Black Flag this morning, so I've been
excellent. Always good to start the day with a
Black
Flag.
Yeah, it was about 7 o'clock. Actually.
With Black Flag, this the first time I heard Damaged, I found it really surprising because I was expecting this enormous roar. And Henry Rollins' voice on that is actually quite lithby. And we rise above. We're going to rise.
It's not quite like that, is it?
Okay.
You're slightly exaggerating what it sounds like. That. Michael, what have you been doing?
Well, last night I went to see the band Diagrams, which is the new group from Sam Genders, who used to be in Tongue.
Oh, right. How are they?
They were really good. I really liked their album, which got 4 stars in The Guardian last week. It sounds... It reminds me a lot of Hot Chip, actually, the record.
It's synth poppy, isn't it?
Well, it's not. It's like a folky version of Hot Chip, almost, because it's live. There's still acoustic guitars, there's strings, and there's brass. But it was a really good show. I really recommend people go and see them.
Excellent.
Full of bonhomie. And later today, I am hoping, let it happen, that I will be called on the telephone by David Lee Roth.
Imagine that. Diamond Dave on the phone.
Diamond Dave. Hey!
I bet he's totally not that. I bet he's really lispy. That'd be hilarious.
I bet he's, yeah, all that stuff about drinking.
David Lee Ross, actually.
All that stuff about drinking and drugs and women, yeah, that's just for show. Actually, through the halcyon days of Van Halen, I just used to like going home and watching Hollywood Squares.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Well, I hope he calls. I hope he rings up.
So do I. We'll be best friends forever after
this. I bet you will. You won't be able to get rid of him.
I won't.
Be like round your house and
all. Oh, God.
Anyway, look, enough about Van Halen. Let's start with him.
You can never have too much about Van Halen, Alexis.
We've had a lot of Van Halen on this podcast in the past.
Only when I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. And once again, here we are. Let's start with hearing those tracks I mentioned at the start of the programme. We've got 3 new singles, 1 each to hear, and we're going to start with Jude's choice. Who would have thought that the side project of Vince Clarke and Martin Gore from Depeche Mode would be a low-key acoustic singer-songwriter? That's Vince Clarke and Martin Carr, imagine that, calling themselves VCMG here. That's a track called Spock. Jude, you brought it in.
Yes, I did. This actually came out the week before Christmas, on the 19th of December, so kind of...
It's a Christmas single.
Yeah, exactly. Sleigh bells on the remix. And I missed it completely because I think it was kind of... You know, slipped out as a little teaser for their album, which is out end of February, March, I believe. Mm-hmm. The thing I like, I always seem to bring in minimal techno thanks to this show.
Yeah, you never strike me as that much of. I mean, you're sitting there in a Kraftwerk t-shirt, so maybe I've got you wrong, but you never really strike me as a minimal techno kind of.
Like the last thing I wrote about for The Guardian was about Jackie Oates, the no more traditional folk singer. It's true.
Well, there you go, you see.
I'm a complicated beast. Now, I really like this. I love it. Does sound like a kind of it builds, by the way. It's kind of like, it sounds more like Underworld at their weird, you know, not I wouldn't say weirdest, kind of slightly...
Starkest,
that's exactly the word. Thank you, Michael. It reminds me a lot of Underworld. I like the story behind them getting back together, because obviously the two of them were in Depeche Mode together many years ago. They got back in touch early last year when Vince Clarke got in touch with Martin Gore, 30 years since they'd really seen each other. That's what the press release says. They might have, you know, met up once or twice, I bet. But they basically collaborated over email, sending tracks to each other for 6 months, and then met up when they were first performing for a Mute Records gig last summer.
Oh, was that the thing at the Roundhouse?
Yes. Yeah. So a very modern way of making music, and a lot of people do, but from two old hands, really. Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah, you know, it's what you'd expect they might make. But, you know, a bit more minimal than they usually do. You know, Vince Clarke has always been the poppier person, and Martin Gore, obviously, the kind of... Darker character.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed that, and this track this week would be either that or I've been getting a bit obsessed with the Pet Shop Boys B-side collection just come out, which I wrote about very briefly in the playlist for Film and Music last week. So basically, my life has been male duos, 80s electro blokes, electronic blokes.
One of the interesting things about this thing is it doesn't sound like it's made by 80s blokes. When I first heard it, I assumed it was in fact some kind of super hipster house youngsters doing a recreation of a late 80s electronic sound rather than actual 80s electronic people. Now, it might surprise you to know that as largely a devotee of guitar music, I don't really have the tools to assess whether this is fantastic dance music or not. But I will tell you one story, which is that some years ago I went to see The Cure playing at the Astoria.
Is this relevant?
It is. It is. And I got chatting to some fella there who had a hat pulled down low over his eyes, and he was asking me what I did, and I was telling him. And after a bit of conversation, we'd moved on to television and films, what have you. I said, so what do you do? And he pulled up his hat and said, I'm Martin Gore. I write the songs for Depeche Mode. He was very offended.
Did you think you were like a fan?
No, I think he just thought I was an idiot for not knowing who he was. But, you know, it was dark. He had a hat pulled right down over his face, one of those big woolly hats. Well, it must have been boiling because it was hot.
Yeah. And he's not like a bald person.
No,
is he? He's
no.
Well, I liked it. It sounded to me not unlike... a dance track from the early 90s.
I think that's why I like it.
I struggle to see sort of what it's bringing to the party. You're right, it does sound
maybe
a bit like
Underworld. Maybe that's why it was a teaser.
I mean, the whole album is instrumental now, isn't it?
This is the only thing that's been released. There's some fantastic remixes, actually. It's one by Regis, which is very good.
I did like it. I just think that I've got quite a lot of records like that already. That's my only sort of problem.
See, you lived the dream, didn't you? You were there.
I've never lived the dream, darling. You
were there. You were there at the time. You experienced this.
You lived the haze.
I lived the haze. I was still in school.
I was still in school. They wouldn't play this at the discos. They played Happy Mondays at school discos.
I'll tell you what, though. Someone should do. I mean, Mute should do it, shouldn't they? A career spanning box set of Vince Clarke.
That would actually be really good.
Picking up on the Depeche Mode stuff, the Yazoo stuff. Also, the Assembly. Never won the great forgotten Vince Clarke records.
That's a really good idea. So I see what else somebody should do is like a sort of nuggets of dance music.
It's bound to happen, isn't it?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just taking you from... I think that's a really good idea. Anyway.
Okay, let's go and set up our record label now.
I was going to say, you can have that for free, record labels. It's the first in a series of EPs that came before the album. It's the first time they've worked together since Depeche Mode in 1981. You can hear it on SoundCloud now. It's also available to buy that track, and the album is out in February, I believe.
Yeah, end of February, I think.
Okay.
On Mute, obviously.
Well, of course. Okay, next track is My Choice.
The pictures are
That's brilliant. pleasing myself. What a brilliant record. What exquisite taste I have. That's Fucked Up, Year of the Tiger. I find myself warming to Fucked Up more and more as time goes on. I they're one of those bands that I started out admiring rather than liking. Admiring rather than enjoying. And the more stuff I hear about them, the more I think, actually, this is just totally brilliant rock and roll. That's a 15-minute, that's an excerpt from a 15-and-a-half-minute long single, the B-side of which is 23 minutes long.
And isn't it part of a continuing series based on the Chinese calendar?
Indeed, every year they put, this is Year of the Tiger. It's got Jim Jarmusch, Austra, and Annie Claude Deschenes of Duchess Says.
The influence of Austra is absolutely clear upon it.
Well, I think the thing is that you get to the end of it, and one of the things I like about this song is it's 15 minutes are used really well, and it builds up this amazing sort of uplifting kind of air-punching crescendo in which I think the female vocals actually have a role to play.
Yeah, they do, absolutely.
I think they provide an incredible counterpoint to Pink Eye's vocal style, because it's obviously is based on this very hoarse, shouting kind of vocal style, and the it's very sweet kind of female backing vocals on it. I put it on in pile of new singles, and I just whacked it on. I was like, this is just loads better than anything else in this pile. They just strike me as a really sort of interesting band. One of the best things we've ever done, they claim. I think I'm inclined to agree. And some of the proceeds will be going to the Save the Tiger Fund.
I think they're an extraordinary and wholly admirable band. I love the fact that a group who are now really pretty successful are putting out a record like this, which is solely for their fan base. You know, no casual buyer is going to think, yeah, the best way into Fucked Up is via a 15-minute single with a 23-minute B-side. That's the sampler. So I think that is amazing. It's odd still that they're considered, I guess, by people like us, as being a hardcore band when they moved so far away from Ramalama Hardcore. Mm. But I guess they still appear on hardcore bills. I saw them last year with Off and with Cerebral Ballsy. Mm-hmm. So completely hardcore. And Damien Abrahams is one of the most charismatic frontmen
he's
can
amazing.
Imagine.
He's amazing. If you haven't seen Fucked Up Live, I cannot recommend it.
He's as near to a superstar as hardcore punk could produce without you being called Billy Joe Armstrong,
yeah.
Basically.
And also, but it's not kind of like a sort of naff hardcore frontman. There's something incredible, there's sort of jumping about. And
he's warm and he's inclusive. There's a fantastic thing when he was talking about his teenage years and saying this is a song about being unhappy and sexually frustrated. He said, I was a virgin until I was 23. I know. Who would have thought that a fat, bald kid would be a virgin at 23?
Jude, how did it...
This is the kind of music I very rarely listen to by choice, I must admit. Generally because I get terrified. Like, it's, Mummy, there's a man shouting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But when I first opened this track and saw that it was 15 minutes long, I was even more terrified, actually. But I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. You know, my knowledge of hardcore is basically kind of, Minutemen, and basically that's it, really. Mm. I would not pretend to know a great deal about it from there on in. However, kind of what I liked about this is there was something about the tone of it and the feel of it. There's something in his voice as well, which I know is a bit of an odd thing to say, but you could hear his personality in the vocals.
His voice is the only hardcore punk thing left about them in the studio, really. I mean, it's a hardcore bark. I mean, but the band themselves, they've an extraordinary grasp of dynamics.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
how
it,
to make a song build and stretch and come back. And actually, sometimes live, they what they survive on is Damien Abrahams' personality and charisma. Because those dynamics, those builds and fades can get lost in a club PA system.
I do love long tracks in general. Kind of generally when this entry is a hardcore 15-minute track, then I get a bit frightened. But I think more bands should do 15-minute tracks. I know we're supposed to say that, everything's supposed to be a minute and a half.
You wouldn't say that if you'd ever owned Tales from Topographic Oceans, Jude, which I have.
I own that.
The thing about it is that somebody said, they said the sort of prog rock influence and stuff like that in it. And I suppose there are. But it doesn't strike me as sort of overblown.
Well, it's not about showing off, is it?
It's not about showing off. It's also just not about... It's not overinflated, which is a ridiculous thing to say about a song that's 15
really
and a half
point.
Minutes long.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like overextended. It feels like it's building towards this sort of incredible, as I said, sort of uplifting, cathartic kind of brilliant ending. I don't know. I was pretty blown away by it, and it's made me go back, listen to the other Fucked Up albums I own.
Do you want to come around to my house after and listen to my old Dag Nasty and Minor Threat records?
Dag Nasty. Our last track is chosen by Michael.
Disasters and the end, it's like a default.
Django Django and Default. I like that very much. That's from the debut album.
It's from the debut album, which is out in a couple of weeks. That's the current single. I'd heard the name Django Django around for a couple of years, like most people. And to my shame, I've got to say, I kind of dismissed them as, it's just going to be it's going to be a Hoxton thing.
It's
not for me. And I went to see them last autumn and was absolutely blown away. Quite my favourite rock show of last year.
Wow.
I think they're what a modern psychedelic band should be. Now, the other night in the car, I was listening to the new album by Howlin' Rain, you know, flag bearers of American psychedelia, thinking, this sounds like a blues rock album from 1971. Yep. I have no idea why this was made now.
Yep.
Django Django feels to me like, you know, if you were setting down to make modern psychedelia, but using the templates of the past, but trying to make it relevant to today, that is exactly what you'd come up with. I love the way that different influences are moved through across the whole record. So, I mean, this one, you're hearing kind of that point where rock and roll is mutating into garage rock, but with electronics going on over the top. You can hear bits of Bo Diddley influences throughout the album. The other point of reference, and this is kind of relevant, is that watching them, I was reminded very much of the first three EPs by the Beta Band. And then Dave Simpson interviewed them for me just before Christmas and came back saying, oh, you know, you're saying you thought they were like the Beta Band, yeah? Oh, their drummer is the brother of John McClane.
Oh, really? From the Beatles?
Yeah.
How mad. Wow.
Yeah.
So I like that enormously.
I thought
it was a really good track. Remixes, which indicate great taste on the part of whoever picked the remixes. Dan Carey, Tom Furze from The Horrors, JD, Twitch and Walls, Twitch of Twitch and Brainstorm, and Optimo, the club and production team from Glasgow.
Walls. See, Walls as well.
Walls, brilliant. Walls album's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
You liked it?
I loved it. Similarly, I just thought the name Django Django sounded like the most trendy name of all time. Let's get this name of, you know, kind of a really influential guitarist that you might not know if you're 18. Which says more about me than it does about the band.
Indeed.
And you, Michael Hann.
Indeed.
no, I thought it was fantastic. And it's funny, something that sounds so instantaneous, it's very hard to try and pin down all the different elements that you did very well. One thing it made me think of, it's like if the choral took loads of acid and then went to Third Man Records.
They did, yeah.
Possibly. I don't know. My drug is wine. The choral made a record for Jack White's label, Third Man. It just made me think that was what the closest I could come to it. But also the kind of element of garage rock, which kind of seemed to be very much around about kind of 4 or 5 years ago, kind of the Horrors' first album and stuff like that. But I love it. That's love a bit of garage.
They appeal to all the musical comfort foods that I cherish, but without actually sounding like a conservative guitar rock band.
No, absolutely.
That's the thing that makes them interesting.
The guitars in that are fantastic.
Yeah, no, it sounds terrific. That is available now as a single. It's also on the debut album, which is called Django Django.
It's just called Django Django.
That's out on the 30th of January. Okay, last week's programme saw us discussing tracks from The Magnetic Fields, Song for Wendy and Shauna. And we had the following responses. Berlin Calling said that Shauna track's pretty good, but it's hardly profound or complex. It's the sort of thing where I'd need to listen to it another 30 times to feel like I got any kind of grasp on it, which I think Rob Fitzpatrick said. Really? That's him saying really, not me saying really. Also regarding Shauna, Sly Mongu said, great, another hip-hop song about killing people. The murderous boasting is offensive, destructive and profoundly depressing. It's difficult to imagine a song which could have provided a greater contrast with the great Gil Scott-Heron.
It's why I won't listen to Johnny Cash anymore. Too many songs about killing people. Just a cliche.
Pop Bijou was keen to point out that Stephen Merritt does have a hearing condition, which I did actually say he had a hearing condition last week. But further details were supplied to us in the comments. Hyperacusis is any sound heard louder than normal begins to feed back in his left ear at increasingly louder volumes. There you go. And on the Twitters, more on Florence, a thread that's run through our last five programmes or so now. Lily Galifant said, I am mystified by The Hate for Ceremonials. It has the same soaring, beautiful sound as the first album. What's the problem?
Ceremonials was all right.
Well, actually, I shouldn't have said that, because it says in my script that has to be the last word on Florence. Otherwise, it'll still be... Still be talking about her when her next album comes out. Also, lots of nice retweets about the Gil Scott-Heron interview as well. So, thanks for those. Your thoughts are welcome as ever on this week's programme. You can do that at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly or tweet your thoughts at musicweeklypod, all one word. Toy have been turning up on a lot of Hotly Tipped for 2012 lists. Three of the band have been there before. They used to be in the much-hyped Jolene and the Jing Jang Jong, but don't let that put you off them. They are a very different proposition indeed. Their debut single, Left Myself Behind, a limited edition 12-inch on the excellent Heavenly label, is a serpentine psychedelic delight. Their live shows, including a stint supporting the Horrors last year, have been widely acclaimed and with good reason. I caught up with Tom and Dom from the band earlier today. How did the band start? Tell us a bit about how you got together, when you got together, in fact.
It started about 1.5 to 2 years ago when, yeah, we finally kind of got it together to put our own band together. We'd kind of been talking about it for a while, kind of had a rough idea about what we wanted to do. But eventually we kind of had the five people that, you know, that we needed. And, yeah, we started rehearsing and, like, making recordings at our house.
Where's your house?
Well, at the time it was in Hackney, right. At Alejandro and my house. And yeah, we kind of started making demos of things to work out in rehearsals. Spent 6 months kind of trying to establish our sound. And after a while, just writing lots of different types of songs, we started to kind of form like a cohesive sound, where each song kind of started to fit in with the last one. And then basically we knew we were ready to do our first gig, which we played in December 2010.
Okay. You said you had a rough idea of what you wanted to do before you actually started. What was that idea?
I think we basically knew that we wanted to incorporate lots of, like, unusual sounds into it, like, yeah, interesting sounds.
All our kind of varied music tastes, which kind of ranges from all sorts of things, like, well, even kind of quite famous bands like the Velvet Underground and the Rolling Stones and things, mixed with like lots of kind of early electronica and things like krautrock, lots of like good German bands from the early 70s.
Yeah,
and we've got like really kind of like broad music taste, and we wanted to try and encapsulate that all into one thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that was kind of the basic idea, really.
Yeah.
And when you say you wanted to use sounds that hadn't been used before, I mean, how do you go about doing that? I mean, the Horrors go about doing that. You have sort of some links with the Horrors, but the Horrors go about doing that by having a sort of electronics whiz kid in the band who builds their own gear for them. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Basically, Alejandro's kind of responsible for all the kind of synthesized, modulated sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We, like, acquired...
quite early on, we got she got a Korg Delta, which is, like, this great...
Like a synth and string machine.
Yeah.
Right. And she puts it through loads of oscillators
and stuff like that. And
is that all right to use live? Because famously, his gear is hugely unreliable. And,
yeah, you know. It's true. We had to, actually, when we were about to start the Horrors tour, like, Alejandro's synth broke. We tried to take it to get fixed about three different times and eventually, like, located somewhere in North Acton that was an expert in repairing analog synths, and we got it back on the day of the Roundhouse.
Wow.
But yeah, once that happened, we bought a second one because we realised how important it was. We literally wouldn't be able to play a gig without
really,
it.
Really, your sound kind of hinges quite a lot on
instrument. Yeah,
okay.
I think quite a lot of the kind of process of the songwriting has kind of been sort of based on kind of synthesized parts and sounds.
It's often
and
the lead
like
instrument.
Often,
right.
Often the initial riff will come from a synth line.
So you're not kind of sitting around with acoustic guitars?
Oh, we do that as well.
Have as many kind of like different approaches as possible to try and get a bit of variation.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kind of into just experimenting with different ways of writing songs.
Yeah.
And that can come from all the different members as well with their different takes on different talents, I guess.
Yeah, it can start with a drum beat or a synth line or a bass line, definitely, or guitarist. You know.
How were you sort of well received immediately when you played your first gig? How did those early gigs go down?
I think like the first couple of gigs, we were still. Yeah, it does take a few gigs to even like be happy yourself, and we were kind of like replacing songs as we went. We kind of had one set, and then the second gig we replaced a song. By the third one, when we played at the Cave Club, we were kind of starting to be happy with it. And yeah, it was really well received, actually, I think. And from then on,
we kind of just played in front of like all of our friends, really. Like the first sort of few months, I mean, that they were the only people I knew about. So this was quite good in a way because it's really good to get feedback from people whose music taste you respect.
Yeah. Was the feedback largely positive?
It was. And I think that was
really supportive.
That was really important to us, and it always will be to like relate to the people around us because we've all kind of share similar music tastes. And I think in a way, it's for them and more than anyone, really.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, all of our friends like still come to all of our gigs and stuff, which is a good sign because it's nice, you know.
you said you played at the Cave Club, which is Reese from the Horrors. Is it Reese or is Farris? I can never remember which one's
Reese's
which.
And
it's
Reese's
night because Farris does another night called something else, doesn't he?
Yeah,
kind of like lots of different friends of ours kind of DJ there.
So you were sort of part of that scene before you got involved in it.
Yeah.
And you said you toured with the Horrors as well. They kind of took you under their wing a bit, would that be fair to say?
They've been like incredibly supportive of us basically and just like invited us on tour, which obviously was like, you know, great for us. We were really up for it. We like each other's bands basically. So we go to the Cave Club anyway and just hang out, so made a lot of sense, I guess, to us. So, they've been really supportive and kind of, they've gone around and talked about us and stuff, which has probably really helped us. So
yeah, definitely.
Really appreciative of it.
Do you think they share a sort of similar aesthetic to you? Do they, band, do you think you've got quite a lot in common with them?
I think we probably, I guess we've got more in common with them than many bands around, but we've got, like, you know, we've each got our own thing that we're doing, which is, you know, we've got our sound and they've got theirs. Yeah, but I guess I can see why people see the odd similarity. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were both in Jolene and the Jing Jang Jong.
Yeah.
Mm. How has that experience affected this band, would you say? Because, I mean, it seems quite an extreme experience, that band, and you go from having a lot of hype to just then everything just going, as far as I could gather as an outsider, just disastrously wrong.
I think the bottom dropped out a bit, really.
This is our band, and that wasn't our
that
band.
Wasn't.
And that was us as 18-year-olds and then 19-year-olds. Kind of just going along for the ride, really. And I think, like, you know, we had a good time doing it. I think it was pretty, a lot of it was quite depressing. But like,
In what ways?
Well, it was just quite kind of, it's not very nice when you're involved in something and you're getting kind of slagged off by loads of people when it's not, you know, you see it as your fault, you know.
I hadn't thought of that. That is quite bad, isn't it?
And, you know, I think it's just really nice now because we're in complete control of everything we're doing and we're proud of what we're doing, and I think if anyone slags us off now, then we can handle that. But it's kind of tricky when you're getting blamed for something we haven't done.
Yeah, I think, like, basically, because it wasn't really our thing, in a way, like, whether it succeeded or failed wasn't as important to us as it would be for this one. As Tom said, like, we just joined when we were 18 and basically had a great time going around, and we got to go on tours and go to different countries and like record with, you know, great producers and things like that. So in that way, it was really fun. And but, you know, as time went on, we, like, after not very long, we started to realise that us three were really, really keen to go on and form our own band. That was like kind of,
it was just
completely bespoke,
like,
kind of designed for what we
huge
want to
musical
do.
Difference.
I mean, I was going to say, visibly, you don't look like the kind of people that would have been into
we wouldn't have not been in it. That's the thing. So it's kind of like, it was weird. It was a really strange time. But yeah. I think it hasn't hurt us at all. I think, if anything, it's really helped us because it's just kind of made us feel more determined to get it right now. You know?
I think we're really, like, glad that it happened. You know, it was quite like an opportunity in some ways, I guess. But, like, yeah, having done that, we just really, like, resolved to go in and like only make the music that we exactly like, which is a complete joy. Because, like, you know, if we were to write anything, it would kind of be to a certain agenda, which was because it was Joe's vision, basically. So we never really felt that free to experiment and we didn't really see eye to eye with him musically, so it's really great now. It's like what we always planned and now we're doing it. So
has it made you? Nice. I mean, you're getting a lot of tour, getting a lot of kind of hotly tipped for 2012 kind of things written about them at the moment. Has the experience, has that experience made you a bit wary of that sort of stuff? Did you, was there part of you that saw that and thought, oh god, here we go again, kind of thing?
Oh no, not here we go again. Because to be honest, it couldn't feel more different this time around. Really? It's completely. I mean, obviously we're really really grateful for the fact that, you know, some like press and stuff seem to like dig it.
It feels like a completely different thing to last time, where it was all kind of ridiculous, the things people were saying, like the new answer to like everyone's bloody problems.
We thought it was a, we thought
like,
that
it's
was
not
a
really like time. It's not really like the way that it's gone this time. I think
it's
more just like, you know, now it's kind of this is a great band, check them out now.
Yeah.
Which is much more kind of
it's,
okay.
It's, yeah, it doesn't really feel like
it's not all
hype
built on
hype,
hyperbole.
Like, it's just people have been like nice about, you know, maybe giving us a good review live or something.
I think a lot
like
of it's
singles.
Been a lot of it's been based on the live shows, which seem to have gone down pretty well on the whole, and the single as well, which has done really well. I don't think that it's like built on any like bullshit really at all.
Tell us about the single, because the single is like is it a limited vinyl only thing?
Yeah. They're pressing up kind of like they pressed up originally
100.
Yeah, 100.
Yeah.
And they've just pressed up another 200. And I think they're going to press up some more as well.
They're going to do more.
It's kind of based on demand for it, really. I think they were just testing the water, really. But when's the.
I mean, on the 23rd, we released these. I think it's either 200 or 300. But we're kind of giving them out to a few shops like Rough Trade and places like that. And like Japan have ordered some and things
and
like
France
that.
France and Germany as well.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, we're just kind of doing a round at a time, and we're going to press up some more just so everyone who wants one can have one, basically.
It's a nice thing, the single. It's a nice artifact. It looks, you know, I mean, it's kind of nice that it's a 12-inch single rather than all available on download, you know. And it looks really good as well. Is that something, are you sort of quite heavily involved in things like cover art?
We were completely involved in it. We got, like, three of our good friends down who are all good photographers, like when we filmed the video.
The cover of the single is a still from the video, which we really wanted to do. We kind of wanted that to link up, and then and then we kind of like changed it into black and white and stuff. So
one of our friends took the photo and another one of them cut it down and made it black and white, and then we sent it over to Heavenly and they turned it into the sleeve, so it was like really nice to do it, you know, ourselves, basically.
Heavenly have put the single out, and you know, there is sort of talk that you're going to sign to them. What appeals to you about Heavenly as a record label?
Oh, they're really, really enthusiastic. They're a really great label.
Yeah, they're passionate about music. I think that's the main thing, and it fits in with like what we want to do, which is to try and release as many records as possible in a short amount of time.
Oh, really? Is that your plan? That's impressive.
Well, we want to. Yeah, it's quite hard to do these days. But I think if there's anyone that can help us do that, it's them.
Yeah.
Because they're just really, really, really into that idea. They like, you know, they don't want to just sort of wait around for ages until, you know.
So when you say you want to release quite a lot of records in a short space of time, I mean, well, what do you mean by that? How many records in what sort of space?
Well, I mean, we just want to like. Basically, we've got this group of songs, which is kind of one group of like 10, 15 songs. And we just want to get that down and document it, make it sound as good as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And obviously tour it. But then
and constantly
we keep
on
writing
the next
now.
Thing.
So
I think that's the only way that it can really like stay vital. Mm-hmm. I think that's the same with any band, you know. I think bands take too long these days making records. And I think a lot of it is it's difficult when you're on bands that are on major labels. You know, they don't facilitate that. But I think that's why it was really important that we signed with a label like Heavenly, who can do that, you know.
They're keen
they don't
to do
mind.
The same
yeah, they want to do that with us.
It's easy to get, like, tied down to the kind of year and a half, like, album cycle, which is, like, kind of fashionable now. But we prefer the idea of kind of writing something that then gets released not long after. And we know it's not easy to work it like that, but that's our plan. Because, you know, if you write an album and then release it a year later, it just doesn't make that much sense to us, you know. We're writing all the time. We absolutely love writing songs. So we just want to basically record them and
you're just going to end up with loads of things that are unused that are really good that you never release because you've got loads of new stuff that makes more sense to you at that time.
You don't want to kind of get ahead of yourself or
it's much more of a sort of 60s approach that you're talking about here. Bands used to knock out three albums a year.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, in fairness, if you talk to a lot of the people that were made to knock out three albums a year, did kind of drive them to nervous breakdowns quite a lot of the time. You know, I mean, people talk about the sort of unmanageable workload. You're not fazed by that. You could handle.
Well, maybe 3 albums a year. So not
I don't know if we'll manage that.
But definitely not fazed.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? That
we've and got to maybe a stage. An EP and some singles.
Exactly. But I mean, it's interesting. We've got to the stage now where you go 1 album a year.
Yeah.
And that seems like, whoa, really? You know, you're really pushing yourself. Yeah. That's sort of nuts.
There's really no reason why it should be like that. I mean, I don't know if we'll be able to release 2 albums in a year. We're not saying that, obviously, for definite. But there isn't actually any reason not to do it.
We just like to push ourselves as much as possible. That's the only thing. And we'll just try and, you know, as long as people can help us out in that way, we like to just get it out as much as possible.
Yeah.
And that's we're going to do it from our end. And if other people are going to help us, we're prepared to, like, put in the effort and the time.
Exactly, yeah. We just want to be as active as possible, really. Just, like, release all of our best stuff.
Mm.
That's Toy. We'll be back again on Friday. Don't forget to tweet us or leave a comment. Links are at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. My thanks to Michael.
Always a pleasure, Alexis.
Thank you. And to Jude as well.
Thank you, Alexis.
And thanks to you, of course, for listening. I'm Alexis Petridis. This programme was produced by Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.